Dentistry is changing. Technology, education, and resources are closer to our fingertips now more than ever. Are you ready to learn what millennial dentists are doing to exceed patient expectations, enjoy dentistry more, and take more vacations? Or how this generation can join up with the previous ones to make for an unstoppable dental team? Well, wait no longer. Here are your hosts of The Millennial Dentist, Dr. Holsinger, Dr. Payray, and Dr. Sully Sullivan.
Welcome back to The Millennial Dentist, everybody.
Podcast.
We have a
special guest.
I feel like they're all starting to get special, but they are special each in their own right.
So. Yeah, they're very unique in their own way. We have, this is our first international episode. We have somebody from Canada.
Internationally recognized.
Yes.
Mr. David Harris.
Well, thank you, guys. It's great to be here. And yeah, don't let the Canadian thing fool you. But before anybody asks, yes, I do play ice hockey.
Nice. That was my next question.
Hey, how about the Preds?
How about the Preds, man?
The Preds, yeah.
Let's just put 10 minutes just to talk about hockey.
The Preds are on point now. Okay, so this is a great conversation because we're going to talk about embezzlement. Because are you an attorney?
No, I'm not. I'm a private investigator.
Private investigator, that's what it is.
What's called a CFE, Certified Fraud Examiner. I'm also a CPA, but don't think I have any idea how to do your tax return or anything like that.
This is terrifying. We're a private investigator. I feel like now I have to be like on my P's and Q's every year.
That's what he was saying. Like anything you say is gonna
be canon will be
of the three of us, who looks the most honest?
Can I think on that for a while?
Okay.
He's got to analyze this job and see which one of the biggest liars. That's a terrible
idea. Embezzlement is the title. Well, we got to come up with a better title.
Something about embezzlement. But this is a huge issue in dentistry, I imagine, as it is a lot of small businesses, I bet. And we are young and naive and just graduating. And
very naive.
So are the majority of the listeners of this podcast. And so I'm really excited about this episode because we just don't. We don't even really know anything about this or that it happens or any part. So let's start with this. I liked what I want. Daniel, let's do what you were saying and let's tell him a little bit about our offices, our practices.
Sure.
And then David, I want you to kind of tell us your background as what your liberty to say being a private investigator, I'm sure. And then and more about what you do. And then we're just going to jump right into it.
All right.
Well, I'm a pediatric dentist, work with another pediatric dentist, and we have a total of about 15 employees. And so about five of the ladies do our insurance, billing, collect post-AR, collect all the money. So basically, they take care of all that. Pretty high volume office. So we see a lot of kids.
How many patients a day?
I mean, probably 80.
Wow.
So
can't imagine.
That's insane.
So it's a lot of stuff coming in and going out. In the office. That's about mine.
Well, yeah.
Okay, I'm going to ask you that question. This is going to be bad because this is going to really get us going. But okay, how much of your, and I'm just thinking about embezzlement, how much of your money moving around is cash, credit, or checks?
Okay, Sully, I'm going to stop you right there.
Okay, perfect.
Because one of the big misconceptions, one of the big things that doctors get wrong about this
is that it's not cash.
Is that when I talk about embezzlement, what they have in their mind is the theft of cash.
Yeah.
Correct.
And please don't take me out of context here. Thieves will happily steal your cash. But it's also not hard to cash a check payable to you, to hijack a credit card payment, or even what's called an ACH payment, which is an automated clearinghouse. So that's when Delta Dental, for example, puts money right in your bank account. Any form of wealth transfer can be intercepted. So I mean, it's a good question, and you can take it up with Daniel some other time, but it's not relevant here.
Well, that's good though, because I think because you're going to get a lot of those questions from us just because we're clueless.
And guys, the first thing I should say is nobody who I ever met got into dentistry because they really, really, really wanted to be a small business owner.
That's true.
Yeah.
Is for you guys all, it is just a horrible curse that came with the privilege of being physicians of the mouth. Daniel, I'm gonna put you on the spot here though, because you went first, and I want to ask you a question. I want you to think about the last employee who you hired.
Okay.
Clinical, administrative, whatever. And here's my question: when you hired them, did you check their photo ID?
I did not personally, so I hope somebody did.
No chance.
I'm guessing nobody did. And let's put this into context. I mean, you said a pedo practice, so you deal with children, you know, vulnerable sector of the population. You also have money. You have access to prescription medications and confidential medical information all in your office. And even after all that, at the end of the day, you have no sweet clue of the true identity of the last person you hired.
This is going to be a good podcast.
Wow, yeah. We have recently started doing background checks on our new hires.
And a background check is fine, but that presupposes you know who it is.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, because
you can do all the background checking you want if I give a false ID, and really all you're doing is wasting your money.
Yeah.
So
the last employee we hired, they had ID that said Jon Snow on it. So
Jon Snow is good.
Yeah. So dealing with embezzlement starts with some measure of skepticism. I mean, everybody comes out of dental school with the same code, which is that you relate to each other as professionals in a very pure altruistic way. And that's great when you're dealing with somebody who shares the code. So Daniel, you're a pedo dentist. Either the other guy's a general dentist.
Mm-hmm. We both are.
Both are. Okay. So you refer somebody to Daniel or to an orthodontist or to any specialist, and you get back a letter from that person that says, I think this patient can benefit from treatment. You are completely entitled to believe that that recommendation is based on what's in the patient's best interest and not the specialist's, right? That's the code that you all have. You all emerge from dental school with that burned in your brain or tattooed on your butt, whichever way you want to look at it. That serves you really well inside the clinical bubble. And as soon as you start dealing with the rest of the world who doesn't share your purity of motive, it becomes a huge handicap. So the concept that somebody might present themselves as somebody else to get a job with you is one that probably doesn't come naturally to a lot of your peers. And yet that's exactly what they do. I'm going to throw out a horrible statistic. 25% of American adults have a criminal record. One in four.
Wow.
So that means one of the four of us here.
Four of us on this podcast. Well, wow. But David already knows, though, because he's a private investigator.
Yeah, he's probably done background checks on all of us.
And he's like, that's funny, because he goes, actually, three of the four of us do, and it's you three.
Well, I've had my own legal troubles in my life, so I'll...
None of us are at liberty to say at that point.
Yes,
so,
yes.
Okay, so, Payman, you go next.
I'm actually in a process of hiring an employee for my front desk and slash office coordinator, manager, whatever you want to call it. Before, when I first opened the office, because this is a fairly new office, about 7-8 months old, and I've had quite a few people that came in and out especially the first 2-3 months. I went through like 8-9 people hiring.
You're really hard to work for.
Apparently.
You're really hard to work for.
Is that you're hard to work for?
Well, it was more like I realized how, gosh, I wasn't doing drug tests. I wasn't doing anything. Like, I would just kind of not even doing working interview. And for some cases where I just kind of got them in and like, let's get going. And then I realized, wow, there are so many things that I need to do prior to hire people, like anybody, to allow them to even, because like you said, I thought about it more like cash. It's only cash. Like, oh, petty cash. How much money we got petty cash? But it's not about the petty cash. It's like, look at how many, you said about 3-4 different ways of being able to collect and bypass the money that comes into the practice and be able to kind of take that away. However, how do we, like 2 days ago, I interviewed somebody on that couch over there that I honestly felt like, and with a great resume, beautiful resume that you'd be very impressed. But when she came in, I felt like she is high, like either high or like
literally high
on drugs or drunk. Or I was like, but I couldn't tell her. I was like, but with this resume, why are you like, your eyes are like stumbling. And I was like, are you kidding? Like, this is not right. Like, there, you cannot be with this much work that you have done with all these regional and corporates and chains, and then now this. Then I realized that after, like, I kind of dug deep, and then she ended up saying that pretty much she got fired from the last job because of she stopped showing up. And she kept saying that she went to doctors and got, she had to be seen in the emergency room. And I just suppose that maybe opioids or some of that stuff that they give, because that's what they do. They give you emergency rooms here. They give you opioids and just get you out of there. But there are there are just so many different ways of, like, that's one of the things that right now I'm struggling with, hiring people that I couldn't trust, like, to begin.
A couple of things I'll say there. Again, dentists in general aren't people who are suspicious in nature. I mean, I'm very privileged to work with the dental profession. You guys are such nice people, such altruists. Most of you would do dentistry for free if your accountant would let you. You really are nice folks, and I'm lucky to work with you. But that altruistic streak that most of you have is something that embezzlers know all about. So, Pan, to use a couple of things in the hiring process. Have you been checking references? You know, have you been calling former employers?
Not yet. I was going to wait till I talk to them first. And then if I like them is when I call their references.
Of course. So, and I mean, normally you're only going to call the reference. You're going to get from the 20 resumes you start with to the three you interview to the one you most want to hire. And you're going to call their references. That's typically how people do it. But let me make one suggestion that might not occur to everybody. When you call a reference, never, ever call any number that an applicant gives you. Okay. So if somebody says that they worked for Daniel and you don't know him, what you do is you go to Google, which by the way is really cheap to use, and you find Daniel's phone number and you call that number. Okay. When you call a number that an applicant gives you, you may be talking to their uncle who's pretending to be Daniel.
You don't want to call
that
uncle.
No, you don't.
So you need to get it. You need to ensure that the information that you're getting is objective. The other one you're going to run into, Payne, and let's talk about how to deal with this one. Somebody who says to you, please don't contact my current employer because they don't know I'm leaving.
I've had that.
Okay. And there are two possibilities. One is that what you're being told is absolutely true. And the other one is that they were fired from that job 3 weeks ago and they don't want you to know that. So how do we handle this one? Let's throw that out for discussion. How do we
maybe call the employer and ask for Janet?
I like the way you're thinking, but the only problem is you're going to let's assume this is legitimate. You will start this relationship off with this employee by doing exactly what she asked you not to do.
That's true.
Yeah.
So I like the fact that we're thinking about how to transcend this. But we need a better approach.
Can you like ask for her last pay stub or something like that?
You could. And that might, you know, but she may have been fired yesterday. So that won't necessarily establish exactly what you want. Here's what I'd suggest that might make this a little bit easier. What I would say to this person is, look, I understand that completely. However, I want you to know that we don't hire anybody without talking to their current employer. So what I'd suggest is we go through the rest of the process, you know, the drug test and the credit check and things like that. And if at the end of that you are our chosen candidate, then we'll make you a written job offer. And the written offer will have one condition, and that condition is that we have a conversation with your current employer, because at that point, if you're going to take our offer, you have to tell him or her anyway. And what we've done here is a great exercise in differential diagnosis, because if somebody is gaming you, what you've told them is at the end of the path, there's a brick wall. You know, we have to have a conversation with your current employer before we hire you. So if they were fired 2 weeks ago and they know that their former employer is not going to have good things to say about them, they're not going to go through the drug test and the credit check and stuff, knowing that after all that, there's just no possibility they get hired. So you'll never hear from that person again. The person who's doing it legitimately will say, okay, I understand this. And we'll go through the rest of the process. And at the end, I'll present this to my employer who I'm about to leave.
Now, you said a few things. Drug test, for example. Do you perform drug tests on everybody that you potentially want to hire right before they want to be hired? Or you just do it on... Because, like, I don't know how much they cost, honestly. Like,
I'm pretty sure I have employees doing drugs.
Drugs are weed?
Yeah, I'm probably sure. I'm pretty sure I bet it's one of
them. I mean, I think I've worked with plenty of assistants that I'm sure they've smoked marijuana that is not legal
in
all states.
Do you advise everybody to drug test everyone? Everyone they hire?
I would not hire somebody to work in a dental office without a drug test. To answer your question, though, I don't think you need to drug test your whole short list.
Sure.
You get down to the one person you want to hire, and then really what you're doing at that point is just confirming that there are no reasons not to hire them. Now, let's be clear about all testing, drug testing, credit testing.
Well, that was the other one. Yeah, I haven't credit tested them.
Criminal records check, all those things. None of these are what I would think of as bright line tests. In other words, they all require some interpretation. So if I'm hiring somebody to be a dental assistant and this person is a single parent with two young kids, I would be astounded if they don't have some credit problems. On the other hand, I'm hiring somebody to be my office manager and she lives on a great big house on the hill and her husband's a contractor and they've got two SUVs in the driveway and they have credit problems. Now I'm concerned because that's somebody who's financing a big lifestyle on somebody else's money. Okay, so we have to be interpretive. If somebody was busted for marijuana possession 5 years ago and they have a criminal record for that, would that stop me from hiring them? Probably not. But if they have cocaine in their bloodstream.
Yeah, it's a valid point.
That's a different story. Or, you know, they were busted for trafficking. Now we're not dealing with a user. We're dealing with a drug dealer.
God, this makes you rethink so much. It's crazy.
They may find the fact that you have controlled substance prescription pads in your office absolutely fascinating.
I have cameras throughout the office that I check periodically, make sure that, especially like, because everything gets recorded, HD, you could zoom in, out, and everything. It honestly has helped me so much because a lot of times that I'm not in the office, I don't have to be because I'll have cameras. I'm like, I know exactly what's going on or what time that patient was there, what time that patient paid, for example, and what kind of transaction, because I have it throughout the office, you know, in a position where it needs to be. How the legality of it, would you tell your new employee or would you want this to be allowed? Like, hey, look, guys, everybody, I'm recording y'all all day long. Or is this something that you just kind of keep it where this is just the way that I run my office? I want everything to be recorded. And how is that in the future, if there's any sort of lawsuits or anything like that, there's always cameras, like go and check the cameras. Like I didn't do anything or she didn't do anything. So yeah.
Cameras are great for some things and not so great for others. They're really good for any event where the time of that event can be established. So for example, if a patient claims that you gave her nitrous and then groped her, the camera's probably pretty helpful to your case because you can isolate what time that patient was in your office, go get the film, and then show that your hands never went below the bib. So for that, it's perfect. For embezzlement, they're useless. And the reason is very simple. Embezzlement can happen anytime. So if your office is open 35 hours a week and it takes two cameras to cover your front desk, you're taking 70 hours. I see him looking around at the cameras. You're taking 70 hours of video a week. My question is a simple one. When are you going to watch it?
Yeah. No, I don't watch it.
Yeah, you're not. Yeah. Unless you have an event, like you said, to go back to see and mark something. It's basically unless useless.
But I thought
if someone breaks in and robs you, the cameras are great because you can go back to the time that it happened and see what happened.
But I thought having it and then the employee knows that they're being recorded 24/7 is going to stop it. There's no way they're stupid if they're going to embezzle because they know they're going to get caught.
Can you see their computer screen?
Yeah.
Here's the thing that sometimes people misunderstand about embezzlement. And if you when I explain this, how you think about embezzlement will change a bit. What everybody wants to do is they want to analogize embezzlement to other types of crime. So can I see a quick show of hands from my audience as to how many of you have alarm systems on your house? Perfect. Okay. And alarm systems
are
really effective.
That was two out of three. Two out of four.
Yep. I'm living on the wild side. I have one, but it's not.
I end up too because I have
one. I have one, but it's not hooked up to like the alerts.
Classic millennial move.
Okay. Yeah.
Let me ask an easier question. How many of you have an alarm sticker on your front door?
I paid more for that sticker.
Yeah. Yeah. The way the alarm guys tell me is that the sticker costs $1,800. And for that, we just throw in the alarm system.
Right.
So let's say that I'm a burglar and I'm walking down your street and my plan is to rob your house. And I'm standing on your porch and I see that sticker. What do I do next? Do I abandon my life of crime and go home and join the church choir? Or do I rob your neighbor instead of you? In other words, the alarm sticker doesn't make my need for money go away. It simply tells me that I can't get it there. So control measures don't turn thieves into honest people. What they do is they turn them into thieves who just need to figure out a different way.
So in essence, you know, like take our camera conversation, for example. If you say, hey, I got these cameras, don't steal from me, that really that all that says to that person is, I need to be more creative because I know there's cameras.
I need to find a way of stealing that's not visible on camera.
Okay, that is a totally different way of thinking about it.
You can't turn criminals. You can't turn people with criminal intent into honest people, no matter what you do. The reason the alarm system works is because it pushes the crime off onto some other person. In other words, your alarm will not change the overall crime rate in your city, but it will move it from you and make it somebody else's problem. The difference between house burglars and embezzlers is that it's pretty easy for a house burglar to walk down the street and steal from somebody else. That's very hard for an embezzler to do. I mean, they have to quit their job with you and get hired somewhere else and invest the time it takes to understand how that person thinks and how their systems work. So unfortunately, if you have an embezzler in your office, you're stuck with each other and they will simply find another way. I mean, one of the things I see is a lot of well-intentioned gobbledygook out there. There are a lot of people who write and speak about embezzlement without necessarily understanding it very well. For example, something I'll see written a lot is that you should take the deposit to the bank yourself. And I'll never say that's a bad idea, but if I was working at your front desk and I want to steal and lifting money out of the deposit isn't available to me because you take the deposit to the bank, that will not put me in the church choir. It will put me in the category of a frustrated thief who needs to find a different way. So I'll say exactly the same thing about your cameras. First of all, if I'm a little bit analytical, I know that there's no way you can monitor everything I do. I mean, 70 hours of video a week is just well beyond what you can watch. Secondly, there's lots of stuff I can do outside the range of the camera.
One thing I thought about ever somebody in being in my front office. Now, again, it's going to be hard if I have 80 patients a day like Daniel's office. But for example, if at the end of each day, I go back and look at the end of the day report and know each one of those patients and know exactly where that money went. And because you get that in the day report. Wouldn't that be the best way to know exactly that day, like insurance
There's
money?
There's probably ways to tweak that, though, at the end of the day report, I would imagine.
So what you're doing, and let's be clear, is you're comparing a document that was prepared from information that was totally under the control of a front desk person against a bank deposit that was assembled by that front desk person. Do you see anything wrong with this activity?
Sure, yeah. I mean, it could all be set up.
Just taking one code out, taking one
check. What you're doing is not, again, don't take me out of context. I think everybody needs to do exactly what you're doing, but it's not foolproof. And the reason it's not foolproof, as my dad used to tell me, is because fools are pretty ingenious. So is there a way that I can cook the day sheet so that it says what I want it to say as opposed to what really happened? Absolutely.
Yeah, 100%.
Am I going to describe here how to do it? No, because...
Sure.
Embezzlers watch podcasts too.
But that would be easy thing to figure out and do. I mean, there's ways to do that.
Yeah. Walter White never told everybody how he cooked meth.
Yeah.
I mean,
if you change that, I mean, there's lots of ways. I'm sure you could do it. But like what he's saying is
there are lots of ways to do it. And if you're interested, and for that matter, if somebody who's watching this podcast is interested, I'm happy to have that private conversation with them. But I don't want to give the fields of embezzlers here either.
All right, David. So I'm in practice with my dad, and mine's a little different, unique example too, because we've had when I came on, we had a team that had been there for as much as 31 years, down to basically 10 years was the shortest tenured person. So you know, and the positive and the negatives to that anywho, is basically we had a very unmanaged team. There was not a lot of management because the office somewhat ran itself. So there was a lot of trust, a lot of that sort of thing. And I imagine people can get comfortable. Since I've been there, we've had a couple two changes up front. So we have two new people that are up there because two retired, and we've added a couple more employees throughout the office. So now we have two, one that we hired back in February, and we did not check her ID. And we haven't drug tested. We haven't credit checked it. We haven't really background checked it. So I'm sure having a tenured staff brings its own sort of problems and its own sort of dilemmas, just as hiring a new employee do. So we could touch on some of that stuff, but I wanted to kind of at least get the three of us out there.
Absolutely. Dentists are, in my experience, evaluative in nature. You all want to look at averages for stuff and compare yourself to the average. You know, what's the average revenue per patient? What's the average gross per dentist or per hygienist? And you want to compare. And you do the same thing with embezzlement, and you all want to know, or you all want to come up with a reason why my practice is safe. And I hear a lot of these. You know, I live in a small town, and really embezzlement is an urban problem because, you know, it happens in places where people don't know each other as well as they do in my small town. Or, you know, I'm an orthodontist, and really embezzlement is a problem for those slightly inferior general dentists. Or my staff have been with me for a long time, or I pay them really well. You know, everybody will come up with a reason why they're immune. And the only problem is that embezzlers don't ascribe to any of these theories. Some of the biggest embezzlements we have seen are from people who have been in an office for 20 or 25 years before they start stealing. What we have to accept about human beings is that at some level of financial desperation, they will do things that they otherwise wouldn't do. Okay, so the potential for dishonesty lives inside all of us. And it's just a question of at what level of stress or desperation we start doing things we otherwise wouldn't do. And let's talk about current events. I mean, there's a huge disaster going on right now around Houston. There are probably people who are hungry. And, you know, would I loot a flooded store to get food for my family? Absolutely, I would. Okay. Would I do the same thing now? And I'm looking outside and it's quite dry here. You know, would I do the same thing now? No. But everybody's got their threshold. Long service employees are as prone as anybody else to get in a desperate situation. And let's talk about some of the things that would cause a person like that to suddenly start stealing. They're going through a divorce. You know, and the two incomes one household that they used to have is now two incomes, two households, and a whole lot of attorney bills. They have an addiction, gambling, drugs, whatever. They feel unappreciated. A lot, you know, we kind of break our thieves into two categories that I call needy and greedy. And the needy is the person with the addiction or going through the divorce or something like that. And they're just having trouble making ends meet. The greedy person looks at you as basically a high-functioning moron with good hands. And in their view of the world, the only reason you're successful is because they keep your chair full and they collect the money and they do all the dirty work so that you can come in and practice dentistry. And what these people do is they wait for you to come along and say to them, oh, Susie, I've been so stupid. I'm going to double your salary starting tomorrow. Okay. For a while, they actually think that you're going to do that. And eventually they realize that that conversation is never going to happen. And the day after they realize that, they start stealing. So there is no practice that is safe. There's no immune situation. Any practice in the I was going to say right set of conditions, but really what I meant to say was the wrong set of conditions can be in a place where it gets embezzled.
So David, how did you get into this?
I'd like to tell you that I planned it very carefully and
you found this niche.
You know, yeah. Totally by accident. More than 30 years ago, I'd left my job. I was working for a bank. I was sitting around thinking about what to do next. And the phone rang, and it was a guy who I'd known in high school who was now a dentist. And he said to me, I think my front desk person's stealing, and I have no one else to call. So I said to him, okay, no problem. I'll I'll come by your place tonight after you finish work and we'll get to the bottom of it. And I went over to his office. This was 1989. I went over to his office before computer. So, you know, it was the old pegboard stuff that your parents, if they were dentists, were happy with. And I saw what she was doing fairly quickly. And we got her fired. And the dentist promised to buy me dinner that has never happened. But who says you remember stuff like that? And I didn't think anything more of it. 2 weeks later, I was going into my own dentist office for an appointment. And I had my hand on the door and I was about to go in. And I looked through the glass. And sitting there at his front desk was the same woman that we fired at the other office 2 weeks earlier.
No way.
Yes way.
Bro. Wow.
So I ran to the nearest payphone because in those days a cell phone was like the size of a briefcase. And I called the office and I didn't know a whole lot about how dental offices function, but I knew I had to get past the gatekeeper. And I knew the name of a local orthodontist. And of course, there was no call display in those days either. So I just called and said I was Dr. Jensen. And I got put right through to the doctor and my dentist and got him on the phone and said, well, it's not Dr. Jensen. It's David Harris calling. I'm the guy who's supposed to be sitting in your chair right now, but let me tell you why I'm not. And I told him about what was going on at his front desk. And he asked me in this panic voice, what the hell do I do now? And a couple of sentences later, he'd hired me. And, you know, I went through this period where I was doing a lot of things, including investigating embezzlement. And it just gradually took over my life. And now we've got a dozen investigators and they're all busy. And this is what we do all day.
What is like an engagement with y'all look like? When do people call you? And is it when they feel like they're getting embezzled? Well, or?
They call us in probably three different scenarios. And at the extreme end, you know, they've caught somebody with their hand in the cookie jar already. And now they need help to understand what happened and try to get their money back and you know, get back to dentistry. At the other end of the continuum, we get people who say, I have no reason to believe I'm being stolen from, but how can you guys protect me? How can you help me set up my office properly so that embezzlement's not going to happen to me, or it's not going to happen as often, or it's not going to go on for as long, or something? You know, how can you reduce my vulnerability? And then we get the people in the middle who have somebody who's acting a bit strangely, for example, and they want us to answer that question for them. You know, is this person stealing or aren't they? So we have really three different scenarios, and the approach varies somewhat depending on those three. Let's go for the middle ground. So we're talking about, you know, let's say you wake up tomorrow morning and you have some concerns and you call me and say, all right, David, can you help me? The first thing I'm going to say to you is it's really, really important that you not communicate these concerns to the suspect. And there are a couple of reasons for that. On the one hand, if it really is going on, you don't want to let them know that they're about to get caught because they may do something desperate. On the other hand, if nothing is going on and you're misreading the tea leaves, then you certainly don't want that employee to know that you had concerns because, you know, if you tell them, well, you know, I was really concerned you were stealing, so I had you investigated, that probably will put a little bit of a chill on the employment relationship going forward. So doing this covertly, in other words, stealth, is really important through this process. And we go to some pretty extreme lengths to make sure that the fact that we're taking a look doesn't become evident to your staff. This is even important, by the way, if you've already fired somebody. You know, we don't necessarily want their coworkers calling them and saying, their ex-coworkers calling them and saying, what the hell did you do? You know, there are forensic people crawling all over the practice. So we do a couple of things. The biggest thing we do is that we do not normally set foot in your premises. So our work is done remotely. And, you know, the beauty of doing this kind of thing in 2017, as opposed to when I started, is that that's all very doable now. You know, if we put somebody on site, which we could do, you know, how do you explain to your staff why that person's there for 3 days? They're there to fix the compressor, probably won't fly.
They're IT.
IT will work. IT Man, will work.
David kind of sounds like the embezzlement like ninja to me.
He does.
Like very stealthy.
Yep. We work pretty hard at that. So staff don't know we're doing it. And then we will work through your practice management software, because that's the place where a lot of the bodies tend to be buried. And we look for the kind of stuff that somebody does when they're trying to hide from you the fact that they've stolen your money.
So what are some things that we can do? I mean,
I don't think he'll be able to tell us unless we get on private level with him and pay him. How much are we talking now? Let's talk about prices, plans. Like, do you want to get screwed like $1,000?
Listen
to it. I'm happy to answer the money question. But in terms of things you can do, there are a lot of things you can do. And I don't mind telling you some of them. Let's start with a really basic one. You know those reports you look at the end of each day?
Mm-hmm.
They should be ones that you print yourself.
Are there certain reports that you would advise us to run?
Yeah, and they're a little bit software specific. I mean, every software has that day sheet or day end report. And mm-hmm. and yeah, you absolutely should be looking at that. Most software has a thing called an audit trail or audit log.
Yes.
And the problem with that is that it catches everything.
Yeah.
You know, if you think about a hygiene patient who's in and has a prophy and a fluoride and a scaling and bite wings, and then there's a patient payment and an insurance payment, each one of those is a separate line on the audit log. So when you think about having 80 patients a day, like in Daniel's office, I mean, if you print that audit log for a year, it's probably 8,000 pages. So trying to use that as a monitoring device is very difficult. But what your audience may not know is most software has a second report. And the name varies a little bit depending on your software, but it's often called something like a modified transactions report. So what that tracks is when somebody goes in and changes something. And that's probably a more meaningful report. Those transactions are higher risk for embezzlement and certain other things as well. So I'd encourage you to look at that. But it's really critical that you print the reports yourself, because as soon as you allow somebody else to hand you a report, the door you open is to what's called selective reporting. In other words, you think you're looking at the whole practice, but you're not. So that's a really good one. Another thing that I'm going to say is, and these numbers are a little bit dated, but still totally valid. The American Dental Association did a study about 10 years ago about embezzlement. And what the ADA did was ask victims a very simple question: what tipped you off? And there were a lot of different answers. You know, day sheet didn't balance, and my CPA found it, which actually happens very infrequently. And I would categorize both those as being financial anomalies. But a lot more embezzlement was uncovered because of behavioral anomalies. So we have the staff member who doesn't want to take vacation. And we have the person who comes in early or stays late or comes in on Saturday because thieves want to be alone when they steal. We have people who are territorial, who don't want to cross-train somebody else to do their job. We obviously have people who have some kind of known issue like gambling or drugs. You know, a lot of stuff like that that I would categorize as behavioral issues. But here was what came out of it. And this was not a conclusion of the study. This was something that I came up with when I sort of reanalyzed their numbers. 2/3 of embezzlement was uncovered not because of some kind of financial irregularity, but because of a behavioral one. So the advice I'd give you guys and all of your audience is that we need to get better at identifying when staff are acting like they're stealing, because that's our best barometer.
And that's when really you come in from a standpoint of what is going on here.
That's the trigger as to whether you call us. In fact, I'm going to make it a little bit easier, because we have developed a tool called the Embezzlement Risk Assessment Questionnaire, which is a 40 yes/no question kind of questionnaire. It would take you probably 15 minutes to complete. And what I'm going to do is, for a period of 3 months, I'm going to make it available to you guys and your audience at no cost.
That's awesome. Wow.
We normally charge $129 for it from now until like, let's just make it simple and say December 31st.
Okay.
From now until December 31st, it's free for you guys. And I'll send you a link after the podcast that you can share with,
your
audience. And they're free to take the questionnaire. So you do this questionnaire and you get a score back. And then what you get is some commentary with it that tells you sort of the probability that you're being embezzled.
Wow.
Well, I can imagine it can be, I mean, I'm just thinking, this is going to be thinking about more even about drugs we keep in the office, anything else you can steal or embezzle.
But I have my drugs in the FBI thing where you have to finger touch, and then it gets audited.
Yeah, and you're doing exactly the right thing. Of course, if I can't get your drugs, my next target is your prescription pads.
Because I don't do pads anymore. I do online.
Yeah, most of us.
I started doing e-scribe. So like everything prescription wise is online.
So
what about one thing? I'm sorry.
No, okay, sorry. Let me stop you there for a second. Why do I have to play by your rules if I'm in your office? In other words, you've gone to online, and you've probably gotten rid of all your controlled prescription pads, right? But what if I order more?
But I mean, I have to sign it.
No, somebody has to sign it who looks like you.
Yeah, but at the end of the, like, I checked the CSMD where you get to see how many controlled substance medicine, like, as far as providers, because that's actually another thing. When I hire that person or anybody that I'm thinking, or even my employees, I look at their controlled substance medical report and see if this person is on a Schedule 2 or Schedule 3 or opioids or narcotics, because that's a free report that I get as being a provider. So that's something that I always check and make sure, like at the end of the month, like how much am I prescribing? And if there's anything extra, then that's crazy.
Okay. You're doing the right thing. And that might stop me from getting away with medications in your office. But the next thing I'll think about, you know, if we're talking about non-cash thefts, the next thing to talk about is you all have this thing. Well, Daniel, you might not, but certainly the general dentists do, called the gold jar. You guys know what I mean when I talk about the gold jar?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. So you take out an old PFM crown from somebody and they don't want it, it goes in the jar.
Right.
Yeah, I'm not checking my jar on a routine basis.
And if I want to go to Las Vegas for the weekend and I don't have money, all I have to do is reach in that jar and come up with a handful of old stuff. I'm sure a refiner in your city, and I'll walk out of there with $1,500, and that'll get me to Vegas.
So two questions I have. My first question is, what would be some tips for new dentists, new graduates who are starting a practice and hiring people to avoid this, or things, precautions to take? And then the flip side of that is, we have a ton of new dentists like myself who are buying into a practice, buying out a practice that's had existing policies and procedures in place. Things have been done for a long time, and you want to fact check that stuff. I want to see what's going on. I kind of want to see, no offense, but I don't want to just take your word for it, owner or doctor, that everything runs smoothly. Those were great questions, by the way. I feel like those were solid questions.
Great questions. Yeah, great questions, Sully. we've talked about the hiring piece a little bit already.
We have.
And the biggest thing there is to have an awareness that not what everybody's telling you when you're hiring them is not necessarily true. And to quote a deceased former president of the United States, trust but verify. So we need to call former employers. We need a drug test. We need a credit check. We need to do a criminal records check. And we need to recognize that for the most part, we are not as good judges of character as we believe ourselves to be. There was a study done years ago, and 70% of drivers rated themselves as above average. Okay, mathematically, it's impossible. I think if we ask people, do you think you're able to spot a criminal when you interview them? The majority of people would say yes, and it just doesn't bear up.
I'll say absolutely no. I wouldn't know.
to believe that we're smart enough. The second thing that a lot of your peers have is a little bit of what I would call intellectual overconfidence.
No.
In other words, they believe that in the battle of wits between the embezzler and the dentist, that the dentist should prevail.
I get you. I see what you're saying. Yep.
Yeah.
And what you have to remember about them is they have all day to study you. I mean, you're running your practice on a very part-time basis because you have to sometimes wield a handpiece in anger to make money. So you're a very part-time owner. They are full-time in terms of dealing with the business of the practice. And that makes it an unequal battle and not in your favor. So you have to be aware of that. In terms of buying a practice, a couple of things. The first thing is that your attorney needs to protect you here. So one of the questions, you know, when you buy a practice and there's an agreement, it's called a buy-sell agreement. One of the elements of that buy-sell agreement is something called representations and warranties. So that's where the buyer certifies to you a lot of things. Is it realistic to ask a buyer to certify that absolutely, positively, there's no embezzlement going on? No, because there's a very real possibility that there's something that's happening that they're unaware of. But in an absolute minimum, you want to ask them the question, are you aware of any embezzlement? Here's what happens. The doctors, a lot of embezzlers have their victims in some kind of compromising position. And this can happen in a lot of ways. You know, if the selling dentist is cutting ethical corners, but I'll give you the worst scenario. The worst scenario is the owner of the practice has been having an extramarital affair with somebody in the office for years. When that happens, that person can do whatever they want. I mean, they can steal and they're bulletproof because the dentist just can't haul them onto the carpet because if that happens, then
they
have the get out of jail free card if you want to use the Monopoly example.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so let's say that's going on and you don't know any of this and you buy the practice. See where this is going? So your attorney's got to protect you against things like that. Now, I know in your case, it's your dad. So obviously the extramarital affair isn't happening, but.
Bro.
But I'm sure. I mean, you never get. If anything, it makes it. I think it can become even trickier because then it's like there's just this inherent trust that like I'm supposed to think that what he's done for this whole time, and then it's even more awkward to like bring up the fact that like, are you aware that your team member's been here for so long? That's a hard conversation to have.
But what you want the seller to say in the buy sell agreement is along the lines of, to the best of my knowledge, none of the current staff have stolen from me.
And so that can help you in a case where you get into something and they're, I mean, what's that doing
if it turns out that it's going on, now you've got some recourse.
Gotcha.
There are other things you should get when you're buying a practice too, and we'll stray a little bit from the embezzlement topic just into generally protecting yourselves. And I'll give you a big one. You want the person selling the practice to say that we have collected co-payments. What happens, unfortunately, to a lot of new dentists is they buy a practice, they never ask the question, and then they find out later that the dentist selling the practice was not collecting co-payments. Now, as a buyer, you have a huge dilemma. You know, if you do what is ethically and legally required, you're going to have a patient revolt on your hands when you have all these patients who never paid for dentistry before, and all of a sudden you're asking them for money.
Oh, they're just billing insurance only.
Yeah. Yeah. So insurance covers 80%. You know, if you're doing a procedure for $100 and what you can't do is bill the insurance company $80 and walk away from the other 20, because the insurance company's perspective on that is very simple. If you're prepared to do the work for $80, that's fine. But in that case, we should be paying 80% of $80. In other words, our whole model is built on the fact that patients have to pay something for dentistry and that controls their utilization to some point.
Makes total sense.
Okay. There's a lot of questions. So, there's so many things.
So if you're buying a practice, that is something that you have to ask and that you have to get the dentist to either certify that they're collecting the co-payments or come clean that they're not. And personally, I would be very reluctant to buy a practice where the current owner is not collecting that copay.
Yeah, especially if it's a significant.
Because now I'm just painted an ethical corner. This happened to a client of mine once. And what happened was he bought a practice with 900 patients. And then he found out there was no such thing as a copay in that practice. He was not prepared to practice dentistry that way. So he started collecting copays and his patient base shrank down to 200.
It's like a startup then at that point.
And it was all because, you know, the right question was not asked when bought. So that's one thing. The other thing that I think you have to recognize if you're buying a practice is it's a particularly vulnerable time for embezzlement. I mean, you have people who worked for the old doctor who probably feel a lot of affection for him or her, and then you come along and they look at you as being 12 years old, more or less. And of course, you don't understand very much. And to make things worse, you want to change a bunch of things because everybody comes in and they want to, you know, they're like dogs who want to pee on the fire plug, right? They have to put their own imprint in the practice. So they come in and change a bunch of stuff. It's easy to resent you in that scenario.
Makes total sense.
Which means it's easy to steal from you. So it's a danger zone and you have to recognize that. Now, there was a question about cost.
And yes. Yeah. Go over that.
Yeah.
It depends a little bit on situation. And there are a lot of variables in terms of what an investigation costs. What time period are we being asked to look at? Is it a year or is it 5 years? How big is the practice? Because a five dentist practice costs more to look at than a solo practice. You know what? And then you get into some smaller factors like what practice management software are you using? Because sometimes some software is harder for us to work with or something and results in a differential fee. The lowest cost for one of our investigations is probably about $6,000, but it could be more in certain circumstances.
Yeah, that's crazy. But I guess you're saying what is that saving you though in the long run? That could be.
Well, let me give you some numbers. There's a 60% chance that at some point in your career, you'll be embezzled. Actually, the real number's higher. We just don't know by how much because we don't know things like how much embezzlement goes on, but nobody ever catches it. From the published statistics, we know it's at least 60%. The average embezzler gets away with it for almost 2 years and takes on average over $100,000.
Wow.
Wow.
That's a substantial amount of money.
It's a real problem. If I were in a practice where nobody's acting like they're stealing and, you know, I have no reason to believe that I'm at elevated risk, would I sort of prophylactically, to take a word from your lexicon, would I do a prophylactic investigation? Probably not. But if I'm in a situation where I've got somebody who's exhibiting multiple behaviors consistent with embezzlement, then I think you have to think about the cost of action versus the potential cost of inaction.
And I guess what's hard for us to wrap our hands around is, you know, you just try to rationalize, okay, well, Aldous, kind of like he was saying about looking at the day sheet and like, well, I can look at, okay, well, if our collections are not close with our production, then something's going on. But if our production's being tweaked in the same percentage that our collections are being tweaked, then we never know. Like there's so many ways for things to be altered that, and we're so busy that we don't have time to keep up with and catch all of it.
And one thing I'm going to ask now, a lot of people said that you can't do this, but I was going to ask you regarding insurance payments, that the money that you get from all the insurances that you're signed up with, can you get at the end of the month or at the end of the day or however you do a report from them that this is how much we paid you this month? Or is there not? Because I hear that you cannot really get a report from the insurance company about the whole thing.
It depends on the insurance company. Some of them have an online portal that you can use, and from that you can easily get a report. Where they draw the line is when this takes them extra work. I mean, when somebody at their end has to manually print this thing off and put it in an envelope and mail it to you, at some point that becomes a nuisance for them. Bearing in mind that you're not really their customer. So if there's an online portal available, yeah, you can get that. One of the other numbers I'll give you about embezzlement is the typical embezzler takes 3-5% of what you bring in each month, which of course can be big dollars. But in terms of will you miss it, the answer is maybe. You know, it's not like they're going to take 40% of your revenue typically. One of the problems with trying to find this by like ratios and stuff is that you always have a little bit of variability. And I'll go to the one, Sully, that you were talking about a minute ago, collection ratio. Right. And just so everybody understands, collection ratio is comparing your collections this month to your production this month. It's inherently an imprecise measure. one of the issues is that what you collect this month is largely a function of what you produced last month. So there's a timing offset. So if you are on vacation this month, your collection ratio looks awesome because your production is very small, but your collections, again, largely a function of what you did last month, are really big. So your collection ratio is 180%. You think, damn, I'm doing well. The following month, you know, the month after vacation, your collection ratio looks like crap. So, you know, it's inherently a comparing apples with oranges kind of measure anyway. What you have to look at is a lot longer term, like, you know, comparing my collection ratio for this year against last year. That's a lot better barometer.
Sure. Because something, unless there's been substantial changes, it shouldn't be too
deep. Yeah. I mean, the other thing that happens is when you're in a practice where the revenue is growing each month, again, your collection ratio looks like crap because
you're producing a lot more. Yeah.
Is being billed before it's being collected.
Right. You're getting your ARs.
So how does the money work out?
Ask about the finance.
We asked, talked about that. Basically, it's a varying thing starting at around $6,000. For you know, and then it kind of goes up from there, and it kind of depends on the case. He said it's very variable based off, you know, how big your practice is, how long have a time period we're looking at, what you're even down to what software you're using, that sort of stuff. But it's okay. More of a case by case basis. Did I nail that for the most part?
For most of our work, we can provide you with a cost in advance. There's some stuff we do where we really can't do that, and we're working on an hourly basis. But the majority of what we do, we're able to say to you in advance, based on your situation, this is what it will cost you. The other thing I'll mention is that we typically, and we certainly do this for young practitioners, we'll offer a little bit of a payment arrangement so that somebody is not faced with coming up with all the money at once. Because one of the symptoms, of course, of embezzlement is I don't have the money I should to pay the bills.
Yeah.
And we don't want that to be the barrier to find, you know, that's the ultimate catch
you're doing
point
a startup
too, where you can't afford
like
to find out whether you have a hole in your pocket.
Makes total sense. David, how can people get in touch with you?
A couple of ways. The first is through our website, and the address is one that probably people will remember. It's dentalembezzlement.com.
that's
the only thing
good.
They know is that they have to do their spell embezzlement correctly. So, you know, if you're not sure, Google it and it'll get fixed. You can always call our toll-free number, which is 888-398-2227. 888-398-2327. Or you can email us. And if it's a panic, I would suggest you use our hotline, which is emergency@dentalembezzlement.com.
Nice.
Very convenient. Well, David, this has been a treat.
This has been
more than I didn't really know what to expect. But frankly, I was like, well, let's talk for 30-40 minutes, and here we are running over an hour.
I feel like,
honestly,
I learned a lot.
Yeah, I think we've all learned a lot. I'm sure our audience listeners have learned a lot. You know, we may even do this again here in a couple months to talk more about our different aspects, because honestly, I think that we'll talk about this, and we'll come up with more questions, and I'm sure our listeners will give us feedback, and we'll have more questions and things that arise. So thanks so much for being a resource to us, and we look forward to talking to you more.
Yes. Thanks, David.
Thanks. I had a lot of fun, some great questions, and I'd love to do it again.
Thank you.
Awesome. Well, you go have a nice Canadian evening. All right, David. Thanks so much. We'll talk to you later.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to The Millennial Dentist. Visit us online at millennialdentist.com.